The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Mr. President, this is my 221st day of publicly transitioning.
God,
and,
love you.
Thank you. I am extremely privileged to live in a state that allows me access to the resources I need, and that decision is just between me and my doctors. But many states have lawmakers that feel like they can involve themselves in this very personal process. Do you think states should have a right to ban gender-affirming health care?
I don't think any state or anybody should have the right to do that. As a moral question and as a legal question, I just think it's wrong.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that's our fearless leader. About a month ago, the president sat down with a transgender TikTok star, Dylan Mulvaney, give his thoughts on trans rights. Boy, lots going on with him. There's been, this is all part of the battle we're in today. It really is. Whether it's transgender rights, whether it is a Respect for Marriage Act, which really does not respect marriage at all. It's such a misnomer, to the threats to religious liberty. And that's where we are today. A little bit of good news maybe to start off with. There's been a win for religious liberty in our country. You know, medical providers are not going to be required to violate their conscience. The Obama administration, they had proposed a rule through the Department of Health and Human Services, through the HHS, that medical providers would have to provide so-called gender-affirming care, even if that violated their conscience. So somebody comes in, they want to have mutilation surgery of some sort, you know, no, we got to do it, right? But if the person conscientiously objected, you know, it didn't matter. Well, the Biden administration finalized that rule. A coalition led by Franciscan Alliance actually sued. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has now ruled in their favor, gave the administration until last Friday to appeal to the Supreme Court. The HHS did not do that, so now the ruling stands. I know it's kind of a convoluted way to get to the end of that, but it is a win for religious liberty. And this is really what the battle of our day is about. When I zoom out and I look at all the stories that we bring to you day in and day out, what's at the heart of it? Well, yes, marriage, yes, life, yes, gender, yes, education, yes, all these different things, right? But at the heart of it, what is it? In the end, it all, there's a confluence of these events that lead to our ability to practice our religions, to exercise our well-formed conscience. And religious liberty is and will continue to be, I believe this personally, in the days ahead, the battlefield. So I pray to God that you'll be able to, know what's going on. Let's pray and let's do our part to form the next generation. See, here's what's the problem. Here's what's going on right now. As a parent, I'm doing my best to form my kids, right? And I know you have as well. The culture's out there too, and they're in that school of learning. You know, they're in the school of real life. And whether it's academia, whether it is friends and the environment at large, whether it's the culture, the entertainment industry, they're being formed a totally different way, totally different message. They're being malformed, unfortunately. And we're seeing that. I mean, when you've got school boards in Oregon, I don't know if you heard this story or not. They decided, you know, we're not going to have, you know, in-person, you know, one-on-ones with parents anymore. What? Why not? COVID's over, right? No, there's a school board in Oregon who says, we're going to do it virtually. We're going to have a virtual meeting. The North, I think it's Clackamas District. It was something I had read earlier today. It serves about 16,000 students in the Portland area. Only 24% meet state math expectations. Only 43% meet English. So it's well below the medium, right? They're not even at 50%. 24% meet math expectations? It's a quarter. One out of four kids? Look, this is our future. This is your future. These kids are the future, right? That should trouble every citizen of this country. 43%, you know, meet English expectations. Actually, I thought that was higher than math would be. You know, I'm surprised. But the board wants to make sure that the kids, they get gender theory. That's more important than knowing their arithmetic, their division, right? Their square roots. Nope. No, algebra, calculus, forget that, right? You need gender theory. And that's what parents are saying. Hey, this is crazy. One out of four kids is proficient in math. Two out of five in English. Hold on. So they're protesting this, right? They want stop the gender theory. Stop the critical race theory. Stop this garbage, right? Stop polluting the minds of my innocent child. The Daily Wire is reporting that the in-board meeting in October, the tipping point came when a mom held up a placard. And this placard had explicit pictures from an LGBT graphic novel called Gender Queer. And guess what happened? You think that would be embraced? Oh, yeah, this is great, right? The chair abruptly, we ended the meeting. That's it. No more. We're going virtual. And that's what happened. Well, if you can teach your kids that and you can pump this garbage into grade school kids, why can't a parent hold a placard up at a school meeting a bunch of adults, right? No, we can't have that. We can't be challenged. We can't do that. Maggie, open your mic. You saw the footage of that? You've seen that class?
I did. I was looking earlier, and I found that clip of the mom holding up the placard with pages from this book, and it was explicit, and people were like, "It's disgusting! It's disgusting!" So I don't know why people are allowed to have these books in their libraries, but as soon as they're brought to light, parents are punished for it.
This is a long-term war. You know, we're in a battle. This is part of it, and the collateral damage are the children. But this is gonna be a serious wound to the future of our country. And you take a look at where we're gonna be 10, 15, 20 years from now. Just take a look at what's happening to kids right now. It's frightening. You know, there was a segment I think Fox did on parents pushing back on their school boards all across the country. And this, you know, we saw what happened in Virginia with Youngkin, right? Parents are saying enough is enough. In China right now, there are protests, right? In a country where you'll be incarcerated, right? Or worse, all over the nation, people are saying we've had enough. Parents in this country, thank God, are saying we've had enough. Here's a little bit from Fox. Take a listen.
It's just that we don't want this indoctrination in our schools. And again, as the ex-Cuban said, you know, I know about this. My ex-Soviet background tells me to be wary of anybody who tells my kids not to tell their parents what's going on in school.
Yes. It's so easy to have this conversation in a place like Florida. But, you know, you're in L.A. I mean, you're in California, running for school board there as well. How is that message being received there?
We're the forefront of this type of ideology, and so we've got an uphill battle. But one of the reasons I chose to run for school board is because I was watching parents be belittled and threatened and called domestic terrorists by our own federal government for standing up and saying what Carol just said, which is we don't care for these concepts to be taught in the classroom. Teach the basics and leave the moral values to us. By the way, this gender ideology and gender theory, this is not appropriate content to be discussing with our kindergartners or our middle schoolers even. There's no reason for a teacher, an English teacher or a math teacher, to be talking about sexuality in the classroom.
You know why they do that. I mean, I love her point. Hey, leave the academics. You handle the academics. Teach the arithmetic. Teach the English. Teach our kids what they need to know, right? Leave the morality to us. But the reality is they don't want to leave the morality to the parents. They know if you have a well-formed moral child, this woke ideology will never be able to advance. And I say it to you every day. I feel like I'm a broken record, but the very heart of this is something very demonic. It's an attack on the children of God. This is Satan hates the children of God. He hates God. It's an attack on the family. That's what we're seeing here. Even in our own country, I hope we get things right. You know, I know we'll talk a little bit later here about a different issue. I want to talk about Christmas and how you can make it on a budget, because I know things are tough. One of the things that has really hurt is the rise in our energy costs. And I just saw a story today that the Biden administration has approved an application for Chevron. They're going to restart drilling, but not here in the U.S., right? U.S. energy has been shut down because it goes against another ideological position of this administration. You know, they've got to go green. It's going to hurt. You're going to suffer. You're going to pay the price. It's all part of the long-term goal. They're going to start drilling instead of the United States or an Anwar or any other place that we can possibly drill in the socialist paradise of Venezuela. And Venezuela is a beautiful country. I've been in many times, fifth largest oil exporter in the world at one point in time. We know about all the sanctions that have been levied against them. Former President Trump pulled all U.S. oil companies out of the country because of the socialist takeover in the country. Very different administration, right? The dictator, Maduro, he took over all the businesses in the country. And what happened? We talked about it for several years now. Inflation took over. I work with a Venezuelan. His name's Elio. And he told me you couldn't buy a cup of coffee with a wheelbarrow full of money down there. I mean, people are fleeing the country. When he took over, inflation took off at the unbelievable rate of nearly 10 million%. We're crying about 8.3%, right? I can't even fathom 10 million%. That, of course, left a lot of families unable to feed themselves. And the move, of course, comes in support of the government supposedly taking action to help people and taking steps towards restoring democracy, right? Yeah. Here's some audio from Peter Doocy. He's a Fox journalist challenging the National Security Council spokesman, John Kirby, yesterday at a press conference at the White House. He had a press briefing, and he asked why the president would prefer, why the president would prefer U.S. oil companies, to drill in, let's say, Venezuela, rather than in our own country. Simple question, right? And a good one.
Why is it that President Biden would rather let U.S. companies drill for oil in Venezuela than here in the U.S.?
That's not an accurate take on the president's view.
Earlier this month, he said no more drilling. There is no more drilling.
The president has issued 9,000 permits for drilling on U.S. federal lands, Peter, 9,000 of them being unused. There are plenty of opportunities for oil and gas companies to drill here in the United States. I'll let Chevron speak for this particular issue of sanctions relief, but our expectation is it won't be a lot of oil coming out of there. It'll have to be shipped to the United States.
Does the president think there's some benefit to the climate to drill oil in Venezuela and not here?
No, it has nothing to do with a benefit to the climate, Peter. Again, there are 9,000 unused permits here in the United States on federal land that oil and gas companies can and should take advantage of. 9,000. And we're talking about one there in Venezuela.
Yeah, so that's Venezuela for you, socialist country. Let me share one final story with you. Michael Rubin's going to be joining me here. I want to talk about what's happening in Iran as well. But let me, Maggie, stop me before I was prepping for the show. I'm in the studio here. And Maggie opens the studio door and says, Drew, you got to come out here. You got to check out this video. And I said, yeah, what is it? Well, she showed me multiple video clips of what's happening in China right now. China's security forces have been mobilized against protesters. They've been taken to the streets against the so-called zero COVID policy. I love that. They were beating up a journalist and arrested him. And the first thing was, he never showed his credentials. And then they came out and said, we were protecting him from COVID in the crowd. Gosh, please don't protect me next time, right? They beat the heck out of him, cuffed him, drug him away. Xi Jinping had shut down a number of cities to try to stem the spread of the virus. But after nearly 3 years of this, people finally got fed up and they took to the streets. And if you can see some of this video, Maggie, are we putting it up online? I don't know if you posted any of that.
I'll retweet one of them.
One or two of them. It's pretty amazing stuff. I mean, the protests taking place right now in 15 cities around the country, they're trying to shut the web down so that other cities can't see this. But police were out in force today, stopping people, checking their phone apps like Twitter and Telegram for VPNs, for virtual private networks that can circumvent Chinese, tech censors. Even credentialed foreign journalists were getting stopped. There was a BBC reporter there that had her videos of the demonstration deleted from her phone. Deleted. They didn't want that out. Police in Shanghai, they put up tall barriers along one key road that people can't congregate. They're just shutting down the areas. Police were even calling people that they identified as being at the protest. So it's continuing and it's getting worse. It's not just China, though. Iran is a story I've been following, and I do want to talk a little bit about what's now unfolding over in Iran. The U.S. soccer team's playing right now at the World Cup. The lead up to the match has been fraught with all sorts of potential international incidences, and thankfully, they've been avoided. But the Iranian team didn't sing their national anthem, and I thought that was super cool. These guys locked arms yesterday. And they did this in union with so many of the families and the women who have been arrested and have been threatened and have been tortured. The players of that soccer team, just for a quick note here too, they have actually been threatened with torture. Their families, the families of players have been threatened with torture and imprisonment if they did not behave before the match, meaning, of course, that they you know, if they make any kind of protest against the regime. So I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, to do that and to know that it might be your wife, your family, somebody else, who knows? But this is all taking place. I'll give you some quick context on this. After there was a 22-year-old girl there who was arrested because she wasn't wearing her hijab correctly. Her hair was blowing in the wind, detained her, and she was violently beaten to death. And as a result of this, now people have really begun to protest at universities. You can see the soccer team protesting. I read somewhere 350 people have been killed, 15,000 people have been arrested. The Ayatollah Khomeini had his own niece arrested after she called for other countries to cut ties with her uncle's regime. So this is hardcore stuff. I'm joined right now by a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Michael Rubin joins me today, and he's an expert in the area of the Middle East, special focused on Iran and Iraq, Turkey, and the Kurdish society. And it's great to have him here with me today. Hey, Michael, thanks for waiting. Thanks for joining me. Good to talk with you again.
It's always good to talk with you, Drew. Thanks for having me.
Boy, I've been watching these protests, and my heart goes out to the Iranian people. They've been going on since September. It's surprising me they've lasted this long, more than 2 months. Fill us in on what's happening. Why hasn't the regime cracked down totally on it? Where's the world in terms of support, and where do you think this is going to go?
Well, you know, that's a great question. First of all, you were just talking about China, and one of the things which is interesting about both cases is this 22-year-old Iranian woman who you talked about was actually from an ethnic minority. She was Kurdish. And what sparked the protests in China was a fire among in the Uyghur area, which is the same group that the Chinese are locking in concentration camps and so forth. And so what's really amazing in both cases is the outrage sparked at the regime by the people about the regime's treatment of religious and ethnic minorities. The Kurds in Iran, of course, aren't Shiite Muslims, they're Sunni Muslims. And so there's a religious dimension to this, in addition to just the desire for freedom and liberty. But where is this going? You know, that's the open question. You ask, why has this lasted so long? Why aren't the Iranians cracking down harder? And, you know, the answer to that is probably the same thing that's going through the Chinese mind right now. They're not sure their security forces are going to actually follow the orders. They don't want to give orders that is actually going to hasten the rebellion and the death knell of the regime. Yeah. The lesson which the United States should learn, of course, is that freedom matters, liberty matters, and we should stop pretending that in countries like Iran and China, people love dictatorship.
It's such a great point, and that's so true. I wonder about the future of the regime. You think the U.S. would be trying to kind of, I don't know, even in a hidden way, help to bring down the current regime. Do the protests, do they have the potential to bring down the Iranian regime?
The short answer is yes. They've already killed the legitimacy of the regime. Wow. The problem now, just as I put on my analytical hat, is that while the outrage is real, I don't see a leadership to these protests. That itself is telling. Right. The regime is so hated they don't need a leadership. But if they want to take it to the next level, the protesters have to form a provisional government. There has to be some sort of alternative around which they can rally.
Yeah. So the attempt to control these protests is brutal. I had seen one report. I think CNN was actually reporting it on the other day. And they gave you actually, believe it or not, a warning before you went to the website. And they said there's adult, you know, content here on the website. And it talked about how basically Iran is using Iran's security forces are using rape to quell some of these protests. What do we know about what is happening? I won't go into the details of the article. It was pretty graphic, but what are we seeing in terms of what's happening behind the scenes, the violence to these protesters? What are you hearing and what's being reported?
Well, the short answer is, again, that's not new. The same sort of sexual violence against both men and women occurred back in 2009 when you had the post-election unrest. Now, the reason why the Iranians do this is simple. They don't want to have to bash a million heads. Yeah. What they want to do is traumatize someone, whether it's sodomizing them or raping them, if they're a female, or, I mean, some cases, holding their head under raw sewage, that sort of thing, something traumatic, and then they will release them. They will send them out on bail. And when they go home, what everyone else in their family circle sees, in their social circle sees, is how the regime has destroyed this person. And so this is a very, very sick psychological strategy in order to instill terror so as not to have to bash a million heads. It's the core of the regime strategy, but the Iranian people at this point seem to say, we've had enough, we don't care, 43 years is enough.
Yeah, my heart goes out to these people. I see these protests, beautiful people. Our administration here, the U.S., still wants talks with Iran over restoring the nuclear weapons agreement that Donald Trump, of course, pulled out of. He canceled. Where are we? And is that in some respects, I don't know, putting a bridle on the U.S. in terms of its response to these protests and what's happening there?
It is. I mean, it's almost creating some self-restraint. There is a lobby within the State Department and within the White House led by the special envoy, Rob Malley, who was once fired by the Obama administration for his embrace of the terrorist group Hamas. What Rob is basically saying is we need to not punish the Iranians because these are our partners. Right. He's losing sight in reality of the forest through the trees, not understanding that the end of the regime is far better than any agreement with the regime. And in some ways, this reminds me of what happened back in 1991. If you remember, Drew, George H.W. Bush's infamous Chicken Kiev speech. That's what it was called when, as the Soviet Union was collapsing, George H.W. Bush went to the Ukrainian parliament and gave a speech basically asking them not to go independent. And the reason why the State Department and the National Security Council had come up with that position was they were afraid that all their agreements with the Soviet Union would collapse if suddenly the Soviet Union did. That's just a case in point of not seeing the forest through the trees. We shouldn't repeat that mistake. Certainly George H.W. Bush learned from it. We should understand, again, that freedom matters. In fact, what I would argue is to go further, that we should, our State Department, instead of simply managing affairs with diplomats, every waking moment should be spent thinking about how they can make, how they can bring freedom to these societies, planning for the eventual collapse of China, the collapse of North Korea, the collapse of Iran. That doesn't mean we send in military force, but we shouldn't take our eyes off the prize.
Hey, two final questions here, because we only have a couple moments left. One with Iran, I hear they're very close now in terms of their enrichment of the uranium to getting a nuclear weapon. That to me is always a concern, not just from the U.S. side, but I don't think Israel will stand for that. I don't think they're going to ever let Iran have a nuclear weapon. How close are they? And in terms of the Middle East, what are we going to see as they progress in that area? I take a look at the neighboring countries, Saudi Arabia and others in that area there in the Middle East. You'll wonder if they're going to do anything to help bring down this regime or what their response is going to be to the current situation.
Well, second question first. If Iran develops a nuclear weapon, you're going to have a cascade of proliferation. Everyone else is going to want one, too, if only to deter Iran. In answer to your first question, the answer depends on how perfect you want a weapon to be. I think we make a mistake of thinking that Iran wants a Hiroshima or Nagasaki when they could just have a dirty bomb. Yeah. But when it comes to the calculation of Israel, the issue is, and this, some people say Iran's not suicidal. Even if they developed a nuclear weapon, they'd never use it. That's the wrong way to look at it. The question isn't whether Iran's suicidal. The question is whether they're terminally ill. If the regime is collapsing and the ideologues have a nuclear weapon, what's to stop them from using it, knowing is anyone going to retaliate against the country that's regime's already collapsed?
No, you're right. There's a lot of questions, a lot to look at, and we'll see what happens. I haven't seen the score of the game.
It was 1-0 U.S. last I looked.
There you go. Hey, Michael, I want to thank you for your time. Always, it's always a great conversation when you're on with us. Of course, I know you hail from the American Enterprise Institute. Is the website for that for that organization, is it AEI.com?
No, it's AEI.org. We're a nonprofit. All right. Close, but AEI.org.
Well, I hope people will check it out. I know you do a lot of writing, and they'll find some great resources there as well. So, hey, thank you very much, Michael. We'll talk soon,
thank you.
All right, you got it. That's Michael Rubin. He's a resident scholar there at the American Enterprise Institute and their website. You can check them out, aei.org. I'm going to have to take a short pause. I'm up against the clock. But when we come back, our conversation will continue. You know, we've been talking about this Respect for Marriage Act. There is a development underway right now. First of all, new polling is showing that Americans are rejecting Respect for Marriage Act. It's a complete assault on marriage. But let me tell you what's happening in the Senate. I'll fill you in when I return.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. It's the truth and nothing but the truth.
And nothing but the truth.
This hour is sponsored by Creative Planning. How are you aligning your financial plan with your Catholic values? Is your Catholic faith influencing your financial future? More information, including disclosures, at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
But while this bill does not move the needle on same-sex marriage, this legislation will raise serious issues for religious liberty. We all know that many Americans hold sincere beliefs, religious beliefs, objecting to same-sex marriage.
In the world, but not of it. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Oh yeah, Matt, you love that little music bed there. Way to go. Good to be with you today. May the Chapel of Divine Mercy is about 30 minutes away. So tell one other person. That was, if you're just tuning in, that was Senator John Cornyn from Texas last night. He gave his thoughts on the Respect for Marriage Act, something I've been talking to you a lot about. This so-called act is such a misnomer because it does not respect marriage. If anything, I think it undermines it. It advanced in the Senate last night after enough Republicans joined with their Democratic colleagues in voting for an amendment that is supposed to give protection to nonprofit organizations that don't support the so-called same-sex marriage. But look, Senator Mike Lee of Utah, he's not happy. He said the amendment, it's not going to do anything. You know, and I was thinking about it after he said that. He's right. He's actually right. The editors at National Review, they put it this way. They said this. They said, quote, "Its provision that nonprofit religious organization, including churches, mosques, and synagogues, shall not be required to provide goods or services for the solemnization or the celebration of marriage is a fig leaf," end of quote. They say this. They went on to say, "The real world legal disputes involved government authorities trying to force individuals like bakers and florists and web designers to violate their conscience by performing work that they believe celebrates same-sex marriage." So the final vote on the bill is going to come today, more than likely, unfortunately. And we could still pray. You might even still want to call. There'll probably be enough Republicans to vote in favor, you know, in favor of it, and they'll breach the 60-vote threshold, and then it'll go to President Biden. What do you think he's going to do? Of course, he's going to sign it into law. That's what's going to happen here. And I was having a conversation this morning with somebody, and I was saying, I don't get it. I mean, are they not doing their due diligence? Do they not understand the implications of this particular restoration or Respect for Marriage Act? They didn't understand. I mean, it sounds great on the surface, but they understand the threat to religious liberty and a whole lot of other things. I don't know if they do. Maybe they do. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. The bill, you know, it's actually not that popular of a bill. There were at least in four states who have Republican senators supporting it. The Heritage Foundation, they surveyed 2,000 voters in Indiana, Iowa, Utah, West Virginia, and Wyoming. Guess what they found? They found that 47% plurality of voters in those states, they opposed the bill compared to 41% who supported it. So right-leaning voters are especially opposed to this legislation. 70% Republicans and, of course, 73% of self-identified conservatives were expressing opposition. Let's talk about it today. Emma Waters joins me. She is a research associate in the Richard and Helen DeVos Center for Life, Religion, and Family at the Heritage Foundation, and she'll bring us up to speed on the latest. Emma, good to have you with me today. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thanks for having me on today.
I'm delighted. Hey, the amendment that was passed last night, what's it supposed to be doing? Lay out how it's envisioned and what it means for America.
Absolutely. So last night, we heard a few debates, including debates on Senator Mike Lee's amendment, as well as a discussion about what the bill text should say, should do. So today we actually will have a final vote on those three amendments that have been put forward. So you have mentioned Senator Mike Lee's amendment that would provide affirmative protections for people of faith. So it's still a terrible bill that affirms a lie about the nature of marriage, especially if you're a Christian. But his amendment would at least ensure that religious institutions and individuals were protected. And then we have two other amendments, one from Rubio and one from Senator Lankford, that would address part of the religious liberty concerns, primarily looking at the private right of action language, which deals with an individual's ability to take a lawsuit against another individual. So it's a good protection to have in place. But those two amendments don't even go as far as the Lee Amendment in actually protecting people of faith from anti-discrimination lawsuits.
Speaking about those protections, I think of people like Baronelle Stutzman, you know, the florist in Washington State, or the Colorado baker, Jack Phillips, who didn't want to take part in any kind of same-sex wedding. What kind of protections are afforded to them? Do they now have cover or not so?
So with the current bill text as it stands, no, they do not have cover. The only way that individuals like that who would like to live in accordance with their sincerely held beliefs about the nature of marriage is Senator Lee's amendment. That's the only one that actually provides them protections. With the current bill text, It doesn't provide basically the framing is like it doesn't provide affirmative protection. So it enables other government agencies like the IRS or other individuals to file those lawsuits like you've just referenced and like we've seen in many other instances. And it just like places a giant target on the backs of religious people and institutions and takes away any remaining protections they had.
Yeah. So just so I understand where we are with this right now, this is passed. The president's going to sign it, right? And I guess I wonder what the possibilities are in the future. You know, let's say a same-sex couple wants to demand to be married in a church, and let's say the pastor or the minister, whoever it might be, opposes it. Can they still be married in that church, or what happens in a case like that if they don't want to be forced to witness it?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I will say, while this is a very difficult and very important vote today, there is certainly still room for hope and optimism, especially when it comes to how this could go. So starting at 3:30 Eastern, we're going to hear from Senator Mike Lee, and then there's a vote on the Mike Lee Amendment, the Lankford Amendment, then the Rubio Amendment. At that point, they'll then shift to moving to a full Senate vote on the Respect for Marriage Act. Mm-hmm. That may include one of those amendments. It may not. It's very unlikely it would include one of Senator Lee's amendments. So what that means is that when it goes to a full vote today, we only need three Senate Republicans who initially voted to move it ahead to drop. So that's actually promising because there are some Senate members who, for whatever reason, did vote to move it ahead. But if it lacked those religious liberty protections that we've just been discussing, might actually change their vote. So there is optimism that it could even fail in Senate today.
That's great.
And if it does pass, then it would actually go back to the House. And then the House, it's very unlikely that Pelosi would open the door for possible amendments. So what would likely happen is that the House would just do a vote on the text as it currently reads without any amendments added. And then at that point, if it passed the House, it would go to the president. So we still have a couple of steps and a couple of very promising steps that could offset this. Right. But then thinking long term, like what are the actual implications of this, right?
Yeah.
The way it's worded is it doesn't mean that as soon as it's passed, religious people will necessarily have these sorts of anti-discrimination lawsuits. But like you're asking, what it does mean is that in these instances, you're going to see situations like that where a gay couple wants to be married in a church. And then when it comes to exactly what that looks like for the church, it's still a bit of a question mark that our lawyers will have to be working out. And this is the case with any bill. So we know that when it comes to tax exempt status, to government grants, accreditation, and licensure, that mm-hmm. that's going to be where the real danger is. Some churches might still have protections they can lean on. But like you mentioned earlier, the solemnization of the marriage is one very particular part. What does it mean if a gay couple wants to rent the parish hall, right, to like have their reception at your church? Are you legally allowed to say no? And then that's where the anti-discrimination lawsuits come into place. Like, what if they want to have the ceremony right. in a field somewhere, right. but then come to your church to like have the reception? Right. Do you still have the right? And then that's where it becomes incredibly right. problematic. Yeah. And a lot of religious liberty concerns are just, on the line there.
You know, has anyone ever proposed that churches, synagogues, mosques have to solemnize the so-called marriage between two people of the same sex? Is that even part of the bill?
No. So the bill says that they're not required to do that. So they've carved out one very right. particular part of it. Right. But once again, there could still be endless like religious liberty concerns just about the right. use of space or other aspects of this that could easily right. come up on the church's premises that would not actually be protected in the wow. current bill text.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Let's grab a call or two for you right now, and then we'll fill you in on what you can do too to maybe make a difference. Joe is listening in Miami, Ohio. He's got a question for you, Emma. Good afternoon, Joe. You're on the air with Emma Waters. Joe, go right ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, hi, Joe.
Why do you hate gay people? What did they do to you?
Thank you for your call, Joe. It's good to have you here with us.
I mean, yeah, so Joe, thank you for your call. I think the important thing to note here is that if with or without the Respect for Marriage Act, gay rights and benefits don't change in the United States. So what's at stake here is not a bill that would actually provide further protections for same-sex couples or unions. All of those rights are in place since Obergefell and would remain the same with or without the Respect for Marriage Act.
Yeah.
So what we're talking about here are not affirmative protections, yeah. right, but that this bill actually would then harm people of faith. Yeah. And so those are the people that we're really concerned about protecting in this instance.
You know, and Emma, to Joe's comments, too, I think it's really clear. This is not about hatred of those who have same-sex attraction. Not at all. I mean, we all have somebody we know or love or work with that is same sex attracted. It has nothing to do with that. This really is about religious liberty at the heart of all this, in my opinion, in my eyes. You know, when Obergefell was initially passed, you know, there was concern that we might see this, right? Defenders of the bill said, no, we're just going to codify, you know, legalizing gay marriage is what they called it. In reality, what it did was empower the pro-LGBTQ operatives to sue Christians, like wedding photographers and Catholic schools and Catholic adoption agencies. They were shut down, right, because these people couldn't get their way. Obergefell did not make a private right of action for, you know, aggrieved individuals to sue those who oppose it, but what it did was something quite the opposite, you know, and the Respect for Marriage Act is such a misnomer. What can we do? You say there's still hope and there is still time. I came across a list of Republican senators who might be persuaded to change their vote on this. And I'm going to grab those names. I'm going to give them to my producer, Maggie, and we'll put them up on our Twitter page. Should we call these people? I'm a big fan of prayer. I'm going to certainly pray. But what can we do at this critical moment to make a difference?
Oh, yeah. Every phone call, every email, every message matters through the entirety of the vote. It's probably going to be the 4:30 or 5 o'clock Eastern hour before we even get to a final passage. And this entire time, the senators are going to be checking in with their staff, and they're going to be very sensitive to the concerns of their constituents as well as Americans outside of that. So absolutely call and email and get in touch with your representatives about this, because it is certainly not too late. And then on top of that, be in prayer, because we know that the hand of the Lord is upon mm-hmm. this and that it is his word that will not return void, right? And so mm-hmm. both prayer and also as many calls or emails, like the messages, even if they don't get a response, they go into a docket that really does matter and really does play a decisive role in shaping how the senator is going to think about this. And so I would heavily encourage everyone to avail themselves of those opportunities.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to send to Maggie at the break the list of the senators who we think can, but call your own as well. you know, and just tell them, hey, I'm from wherever. You might be listening in Florida or in, you know, Seattle. You know, I don't know where you are. You might be down in Austin, Texas, or in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. You might be in our heartland, wherever you're listening. Say, here's where I'm from, and here's where I stand on the issue, and just let them know. All right? It's an important thing to do. And if people want more information, let me put a plug in for Heritage and what you're doing. Do you have a resource that people can get a little bit more information on this or maybe direction?
Yes, absolutely. So if people Google the Heritage Foundation Respect for Marriage Act, it will actually take them to a page with all of the opinion pieces, many of the radio hits, and some of the legal analysis that we've done regarding this bill that will give them all the information that they need to be able to articulate and think through the issues that you and I have talked about in even greater detail. So if they go to heritage.org and they type in the Respect for Marriage Act, they'll see a ton of resources addressing these very questions and can use that. Yeah.
That's awesome. Hey, first of all, I really want to thank you for your position here, and for I thought it was over and done, to be honest with you, and I'm glad there's still hope. It's never too late, and I really hope people will call their senators. I hope they're aware of what this means for religious liberty and how this can really, it's very fuzzy, how it can still really affect a lot of innocent people. But hey, Emma, keep up the good work. We'll follow this, see where it goes, and look forward to the next time you can stop by. It's always good to talk with you.
That sounds great. Thank you for all your work.
Thank you. That's Emma Waters. She's a research associate in the Richard and Helen DeVos Center for Life and Religion and Family at the Heritage Foundation. Do yourself a favor now. Google Heritage Foundation Respect for Marriage Act. Heritage Foundation Respect for Marriage Act. And you can get all the info there. And I am going to send Maggie during this break a rundown of senators. This comes from Catholic Vote. Oh, you did. Thank you. Thank you very much. Maggie just posted it. And there's phone numbers for these senators who really are on the fence on this. We're in a battle for religious liberty in this country. This is a major, it's a big war. This is a major battle that will have incredible consequences. Don't sit back and be apathetic and think, oh, I'll let somebody else. Oh, it doesn't really affect me. Oh, believe me, you can do something today that can have a profound impact. Call that senator. All right. Do your due diligence research, but do it now because I'm sure they're going to be voting on that pretty soon. All right. I've got to take a short pause. Stay with me. I'll be back with more right after this.
Insight and analysis right here. It's the Drew Mariani Show. Relevant Radio.
Catholic Order of Foresters, the sponsor of our studio line, is hiring today with several positions throughout the U.S. Visit relevantradio.com/forester to learn more about how you can find your vocation with COF. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not licensed in all states.
Tell one friend about the Chaplet of Divine Mercy.
I'm not holding a small cup, Drew. I'm holding an extra large cup.
A bucket.
Every weekday at 4 Eastern, 1 Pacific on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about that. We got the Chaplet coming up in about 8 minutes. Why am I excited? Because we can pray for real protection, for clarity of mind, conversion of heart, you know, for rationality to prevail, for protection of marriage as God intended it in this country. That's what we have to do. Let's pray for those men and women who we put in office. You know, I was having a conversation this morning with one of my producers, and I said to him, look, I must have been wrong. I really thought when it came to the midterm elections that the economy, you know, how much money it's now costing you to fill up your tank, or how expensive food has gotten, or the, you know, the supply chain issues, all these other things, the energy cost, yeah, that would have played a big role. But apparently the life issue is so critical. I saw a very short bit of news, I think it was yesterday or today, where they were interviewing people down in Carolina, under Georgia. They were down in Georgia, and it was the Warnock Walker race. And one gray-haired older woman coming out of her church or wherever it was, they asked who she was voting for, and she said, "I'm voting for Warner, because is it Warner or Warnock? Warnock, because you know, life matters, and a woman should have the right to choose." So I said, "Life matters." She was all about abortion, is really what she was all about. And she's voting for a pro-death candidate, and I'm like, maybe I was wrong. Maybe the pro-death. I don't know. Maybe abortion is most important, you know. Maybe that's critical. I don't know to people. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe these issues of life and marriage, they don't matter. But we get who we vote for, right? We do. And apparently people didn't care. The economy wasn't as important to them as killing a child in the womb. Apparently, you know, marriage is not as important as putting into office men and women who are willing to redefine it. And in the end, you know, we'll see the ripple effects of that, as I've said, since the Obergefell decision. And that's going to be an attack on our religious liberty. That's what we are seeing today, you know. So I don't know. just some food for thought. I thought I had my finger on the pulse of what was happening, but we live in a time where there's a great spiritual darkness, a bedimming of the intellect, a darkening of the mind, a hardening of the heart. And the only thing that can pierce that is love, right? It's the only thing that brings about conversion. And it's hard sometimes to love when gosh, you're being attacked and you see your rationality. But let's pray for that. Let's pray for conversion. Let's pray for a greater love in our own heart and in this country. Things can only go so far in one direction. Evil feeds on itself and it'll ultimately collapse. Ultimately. But there'll be a lot of suffering along the way. I mean, you take a look at a lot of these communist countries and take a look at these other avenues that people have gone down that led away from God. It ends in misery and suffering, but ultimately it collapses. We don't have to do that. We do not have to go down that path. So let's pray for our country when we come back. Let's pray for marriage. Let's pray for life. All right. Hey, just another quick programming note for you here, if I could throw this out to you. Tomorrow begins the St. Andrew Novena. This is a 30-day novena, and it's a powerhouse one. And what I'm going to ask you to do, if you've prayed it with me in the past or if you've ever prayed it, and you've had an answered prayer to that, please email me and let me know or give me a call tomorrow. Because I'm going to share a little bit more about the history behind it and some of the fruit of it. But I really want to open the phones. I want to hear your testimonies on this novena. You know, St. Andrew is one of my namesakes, right? I often turn to him. One of my son's middle name is Andrew. And my wife and I are going to start a novena for him for 30 days. I do have a little bit of a problem with the novena. I'll tell you about that tomorrow, though, and what we're going to do. Maggie and I were talking a little bit about it. So, but that's coming up. And if you want to join me today for the chaplet, you can do that right now at 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. One final note here, too, and I was going to share maybe with you, maybe I'll do it a little bit later if I have time, a great story on a pope, you know, Padre Pio, who had this revelation that there was actually a pope in purgatory. And you're like, how can a pope be in purgatory? Well, had a lot of martyrs, right? We've had a lot of very holy popes, right? We've also had some popes that perhaps weren't so great. But, you know, if you made it to purgatory, you've made it, right? Yeah, you're in. But I'll share that story. But I was going to share it with you just simply because I want to remind you that you can still get that November indulgence. And I'm calling you to, you know, be vocal about the restoration, the Marriage Restoration Act. It's not too late. It's not too late to tap into this indulgence. You have two more days. You have today and tomorrow, and then that is it. And that means you can either get a plenary or a partial indulgence for a soul in purgatory. And as I said before, normally this was only an eight-day thing. But Pope Francis, and I'm very grateful for this, extended it the entire month. And you know, all you have to do is visit a cemetery and pray for the souls of the dead. And of course, all the other usual conditions of going to confession and receiving Holy Communion and praying for the intentions of the Holy Father are necessary. But the final thing, too, is, of course, having no attachment to sin. But I always go back to what I always say, do your best, right? Trust in the mercy of God. Do your best. But the Vatican is allowing this indulgence to be gained during the entire month of November. We have two more days. And you know what? I'll be honest with you. I haven't taken advantage of it as much as I should. Somebody called yesterday and said, can I drive to the cemetery and sit in the car? Yeah, you can do that. You can do that. But do it and certainly pray. And maybe if I have time a little bit later, I'll share with you that story. It's a pretty powerful story that Padre Pio had, an encounter with a purgatorial soul. We'll pray the chapel, though, when we return for those dying, those who are coming back. In fact, I'll share with you a series of emails I got last night. And I was checking through these, and I just, it's so weird how a current flows through the show, sometimes with prayer intentions, sometimes with miracles. So we come back. I'll fill you in on that. We got a lot to get into, okay? Feel free to join me, 888-914-9149. We'll pray right into this.